Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
This is me. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. Before I get to my guest, whom I'm actually looking forward to in an unusual way, because he has a very in-depth way of looking at things, not just philosophic, which is a good thing, but can be superficial and standardized, but really a thoughtful, philosophical way of looking at a lot of the issues in our field. And I think you're going to benefit from it. Before getting to that positive stuff, I want to catch you up on some of what I'm doing in regard to electroshock treatment, ECT. I just had a deposition yesterday. I'm a medical expert on behalf of a woman who has had 86 ECT. 86 ECT. It's such a boggling number that sometimes I get confused and I call it 67 ECT or some other number. I've met this woman and she has the misfortune to show in her lack of memory and self-awareness and so on the effects of this treatment. I can't talk more about it. Maybe I could, but I won't talk more about it since it's an active case. But inspired in part by this case at an earlier date and by another consultation from a man who had ECT, it wasn't for a legal case, by the fact that I'm getting more calls again about ECT cases, I've decided to and have been setting aside a great deal of my time on a project that I'm going to be setting up on the internet on Bregan.com as a start, which will provide free access to more than 100 articles about the damaging effects of ECT. I wanna put up, you know, as much as I can of what I know and what I have as my resources for other people to use in standing up to this treatment and in helping friends and family not take this treatment. I'm also going to put up a brochure for the first time that just gives a really quick intro for family members and for other people, therapists who want to let folks know that ECT is not good for the brain. And I'm going to be able to do that now. I feel comfortable doing that now, and I didn't in the past, because I can say to folks, to back up the brochure, here's 100 articles. The articles are more than 100. It's going to have a table of contents with search words like brain damage, memory loss, women, abuse, children, the elderly, and so on. It's a big project. I feel kind of under marching orders from the Great Spirit to do this work, to put this up on the website. One of the issues that's come up that really indicates the perversion of thinking in ECT is that psychiatrists who support ECT and claim that there is no evidence at all for brain damage, none at all, they get angry if you suggest there is, are now claiming that they now know some of the benefits of ECT. Modern science is giving us the evidence we need to show that ECT is helpful. One of the examples they give is that following ECT, there is in the blood an increase in the bloodstream of something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. By the way, when my new ECT resource center goes up, which I think will be certainly by the first week of June, certainly in the next couple of weeks, maybe sooner, when this goes up, you'll be able to just put in BDNF. And what you'll find is that the research is showing an increase in BDNF following electroshock to humans and to animals. The human research is done by shock docs who claim what a good thing to be able to stimulate BDNF. The other literature, for example, head trauma in humans, head trauma in rats, electroconvulsive trauma in rats, is that, in fact, BDNF is a response to brain injury. It can be used as a marker showing that ECT causes brain injury. In regard to BDNF, first, it's a marker in terms of the brain's response to being injured, that it's secreting growth factors, probably a wide variety of them, of which we're looking at BDNF. And secondly, that it's in the blood because the blood-brain barrier has been injured and this brain-derived substance is in the bloodstream. The second thing that shock doctors are claiming is that neurogenesis, the appearance of new neurons in the brain after ECT, is another demonstration of how it may be working. But neurogenesis, which is a newly conceived scientific concept that the brain can produce new neurons, neurogenesis is again a response to brain injury. So we now have two factors that indicate that and confirm and prove that ECT is causing brain injury: the presence of BDNF and the presence of neurogenesis in humans and in animals, being distorted by the shock docs who want us to think this is a helpful thing when it's a marker. Well, all these articles and covering a whole wide variety of issues, including the political issues surrounding shock, are going to be on the web in one place in the Bregan ECT Resource Center on my website within a week or two. I just wanted to communicate to you, and you can tell probably from my tone of voice with a certain amount of sadness and grief that this has to be done, that this is happening to people. Now, having finished that, Mel Schwartz, are you there?
Certainly am, Peter.
Mel is new to me, like so many of my guests with great gratification. I'm not new entirely to him. Mel is a psychotherapist and a marriage and family counselor. As an aside, if you're looking for a therapist, I think one of the best places to look is in whatever section of the web or the yellow pages you're all looking at for marriage and family counselors, because they're actually trained in how to help folks. So I think that's a good beginning for looking for a therapist. And since I think that working with the family is almost always the best approach to helping people, especially if it's a loving family that wants to stay together and if there are children involved. So Mel is a marriage and a family counselor. He's got one book out and another coming. The book out is The Art of Intimacy, The Pleasure of Passion. And he's currently completing a new book called A Shift of Mind, which we'll be talking about today, his ideas on what is a shift of mind. He's written over 200 articles, which you can read on his blog. I'm not sure how you get to it, but it's called A Shift of Mind. He'll tell us how to get to it. He's working on concepts like emerging thinking, which he sees as being rooted in emerging science. Now, you know, I might differ a little bit about how much you can extrapolate from physical science. We may get to chat about that. But that's all right with me, because I think that the work he's doing, the direction he's going in is absolutely the right way to go. His practice is in Westport, Connecticut, and he works with individuals and couples internationally, which I guess he means he works on the web. And his website is Mel Schwartz. That's Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z. It's melschwartz.com. Mel, welcome to the show. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
And I with you, Peter. I've been a long-time admirer of yours.
Oh, well, go ahead and say that. I just got beat up in a deposition for 7 hours. Tell me how I'm a long-term...
reading of your book, Toxic Psychiatry, and I don't track back in time very well, but I was going through some major life transitions, and reading your work, it verified and it validated what I always felt I intuitively knew. And, you know, there are moments in life when you receive that kind of validation, and it sets up a bifurcation, a choosing of a new path forward, a defining moment. And I take defining moments in my life, I've had a few, to reorganize who I think I am and how I want to experience my life. And so I'm very gratified to have not only read your book, now have an opportunity to actually meet you and speak with you.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for that. I always need encouragement after being in the deposition. Because they're so hostile, and the twisting and distortions by other attorneys in defense of doctors is often quite mind-bending. Why don't you just launch into what you want to talk about?
Well, certainly. I guess I'll begin with what brought my work to your attention. Several weeks ago, there was a front-page article in the New York Times, which indicated that 1 out of 5 American school children will be diagnosed with ADHD. And that prompted me to write an article. And by the way, my blog is ashiftofmind.com, and that's how you can access my writing. And the article I wrote was Diagnosis Disorder. And that was the title. And what I proposed is this, that I suggest that the DSM has a disorder. And their disorder is they confuse a diagnosis with being an actual thing. Now, here's what I mean. Team of psychiatrists gets together. They discuss some new symptoms and behaviors they're seeing. And so they describe those behaviors. And in this case, they describe them with the words attention deficit hyperactive disorder. To that point, no argument. They're describing behaviors. They're not delving into the complexities, into what leads people to these behaviors, or perhaps taking a look at the cultural illness that drives us in that way. But they create a diagnosis. Now, if I'm walking down the hall in my office and I run into another therapist and she's talking to me about a client of hers and she says, you know, my client Jane has ADHD. And I'll look at her quizzically and say, what do you mean? She says, well, she has ADHD. And I'll say, I haven't any idea what you're talking about. How can she have something that doesn't exist? And then I'll launch into my explanation. You see, mind has a way of tricking us. Our minds create things, constructs, terms. This is called reification, or the great philosopher Alfred North Whitehead called it the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, which simply is mind creates a term or an expression to describe phenomenon, and that's fine. But then mind makes believe it didn't create the term, that the term is real. So my point here is that ADHD, or any diagnosis, doesn't exist unto itself. It needs to be seen as a description. And as a description, we're free to then go out in a subjective way and look at that description and see to what extent it fits somebody and begin to work with it. Let's look at the word ego, Peter. We all talk about ego as though it's an actual thing and it exists. It doesn't. It's not the same as saying someone has the West Nile virus, which arguably they do have. So these terms trick us and fool us, and they trick us into believing in objectivity. Now, I think that the belief of objectivity does us great damage. Many years ago, I was called in as a juror on an alleged rape case, and I indicated to the attorneys that I needed to speak with them privately, and so I found myself in judge's chamber with the prosecuting attorney and defense attorney, and I said, you know, gentlemen, I've had many occasion to work with victims of sexual abuse, and you need to know that. And the DA said to me, asked me, well, can you be objective? And I launched into a litany of why objectivity doesn't exist. Firstly, quantum physics explains that in the quantum realm, there is no such thing as objectivity. Everything in the universe participates with everything else and interpenetrates. And much of this is now true in our level, the macro level. So what I said to them is, you should ask me if I can be in touch with my bias and therefore do the best job I can. You see, everyone's biased. If you have a belief is a bias, isn't it? So how will we play this game of objectivity? And in my field, in the field of psychotherapy, it's ruinous. I think in psychiatry, it's even more ruinous. We're going to sit back and imagine that in our objective ability, we can diagnose as though we aren't, in fact, feeling sensitive, interpretive human beings who have a lifetime of bias built up in us. So we then end up treating the diagnosis rather than the person. That is dehumanizing, limiting, and cruel punishment. And I have just refused to ever work that way. I work with somebody's potential. We all suffer. We all struggle. That's part of the human experience. But I work from a person's potential. How do I help them get past their fears, their limitations, their self-limiting beliefs, so that they can thrive? And that those are my brief objections to diagnosis.
Mel, I like what you're saying a lot. I'd like you to even elaborate some more about this incredibly important observation, which I don't think has been made on my show, and which isn't made enough for people to hear about, which is that the naming of something gives it an independent validity which it doesn't have.
This all begins, Peter, with how thought operates. By the way, much of my learning about thought came from my reading of the late Nobel Prize-winning quantum physicist David Bohm. David Bohm moved from the realm of science into the room, into the field of exploring the nature
of thought. Spell his last name for us, Mel.
Bohm, B-O-H-M, David Bohm. And for any of your listeners who have specific questions about this, send me an email, and I'll give you great references. My email address is mel@melschwartz.com. So David Bohm did some work with the Indian philosopher Krishnamurti on the nature
that
of thought.
That can't be your email. You mean Mel Schwartz at?
It's mel@melschwartz.com.
At Mel Schwartz. Mel@melschwartz.com.
So
thank
what
you.
I understood from David Bohm was that we all operate typically from what's called literal thought. Literal thought tricks us. It tricks us in that it's telling us the truth out there. And that truth is about an objective reality, which we were trained to believe exists. We were trained that back in the 17th century by the work of Sir Isaac Newton, which I think I'll address in a little while. But to stay on topic right now, that's how literal thought tricks us. So in a relationship, literal thought could be, he thinks to himself, he has a thought about his wife, and he says, she is such an insensitive, cruel person. That's literal thought. It's telling him the truth. Now, what we need to do is move into participatory thought, because the new worldview is that the entirety of the universe is participatory, which includes us. We all are co-creating reality together. So participatory thought would sound like this. I'm having a thought, and my thought is telling me that my wife is cruel and insensitive. I can work with that because I'm taking ownership of the fact that I'm having a thought. I can see the thought, I can see its subjective representation, and I can choose how to deal with that. I take ownership of the thought. So coming back to your question, Peter, a team of psychiatrists have a thought that they're going to put a description together to describe certain behaviors. Behaviors of individuals who are lacking in attention and or are hyperactive. They're not looking at the food they eat and what they're drinking or their home environment or technology. They're simply looking at the behaviors. So they create a construct, ADHD, and we, like fools, run around thinking it's a real thing. Does he or doesn't he have ADHD? How can he have something that we made up? And again, this is much more pervasive than in the world of psychiatry. This impacts us everywhere, in politics, in relationships. It's the death knell of effective communication. And I've written extensively about how to break through this, actually by eliminating the to be verbs. If we don't speak with using the words be, am, is, were, if we eliminate the to be verbs, we start our sentences with I. I feel, I think, I perceive. By the way, one of the advantages of speaking that way is you can't be told you're wrong because you're only sharing your perception. When we get out of making objective statements, we can have a dialogue which can become generative. I find it's very, very effective in couples counseling, and it's essential to effective communication.
I like everything you're saying. I think it's all very important. My mind just, I'm so involved in these legal work right now, my mind just went off to lawsuits and how the effective testifier is supposed to say, my conclusion is that
yeah.
you are blah, blah, blah. And it's, of course, the exact opposite of what you're suggesting,
precisely. It's the opposite of the legal field. Frankly, it's the opposite of the scientific and academic community. This movement towards speaking without the to be verb is called E-prime language. Great book written, I think, in the 1930s called Science and Sanity by an engineer named Alfred Korbziski. He first promulgated the idea that we need to have language consistent with how reality actually operates. Now, you see, the participatory universe, the new worldview, through emerging science, tells us that nothing is static. Everything is flowing and moving in inexorable change. It's unfolding, it's interconnecting, it's full of potential. So look what happens when we as people use words like am. I'm working with a client, and he says, I am worthless. And that's a fixed statement. It's an unchanging statement, and it's damaging. So I explain E-prime language. We have to remove the word am. So I ask him, how would you say that without saying am? And he thinks for a moment. He says, I feel worthless. Oh, it's quite different. And he actually starts to smile a bit, and I ask him, why are you smiling? And he says, well, if I feel worthless, that could change. Yes, indeed. I am worthless is an objective statement. It's a statement, again, coming from the belief in objectivity, which came to us from Sir Isaac Newton. Objectivity and the belief in it does immeasurable damage in our lives. And for people who suffer from anxiety, their thoughts and the tendencies of their thoughts to criticize themselves paints them into a corner. I've had great success helping people overcome anxiety by understanding that the tendency of our thought to measure and analyze ourselves is what induces the anxiety. And once we can come into literal thought where we can see the thought and don't have to become the thought, we can free ourselves. We don't have to be servant to our thoughts.
I'm just listening. Usually I'm interacting more.
Well,
I'm actually taking notes.
I can keep going. By the way, I have a DVD on this subject of a talk I gave. It's called The Power of Mind, and people can access it download it on my website. And it's all about this process I've developed, which I call emergent thinking. And what I do is I borrow from the quantum physics field, and I borrow metaphorically. I'm not a scientist, and I don't read the formulas. I look at the discoveries, and I say, that's fascinating. You know, 20 years ago, I went through a major life transition. I had been in business, and it didn't suit me. And I thought, I don't want to live out my life this way. And I had several epiphanies. And I started to read about some of these discoveries, and just briefly, perhaps the most mind-boggling discovery of all time in science is little known. It began in the 1930s with a thought debate. On one side of the debate was Albert Einstein. And on the other side was the great physicist Niels Bohr. And here's how the debate went. When two particles are enmeshed, or they share a same state, that's called entanglement in quantum physics. So the debate was, if we take these two particles and they have opposite spins or rotations, so if one particle has a negative spin, its twin has a positive spin. They have opposite spins. So the debate was, if we separate them by a great distance and we alter one spin, what will happen to the spin of its twin? Now, both men agreed that its twin will then alter its spin because they must be in opposition. Well, the debate was, how long would it take? Einstein said, well, a signal will be sent, and that signal, of course, cannot go faster than the speed of light or reach the speed of light, so we can calculate the time. Niels Bohr, to the astonishment of most people, said, no time will surpass, no signal will be sent, they are as one, inseparable. So these two particles could be half a universe apart, and Bohr's position is the change will be instantaneous. With that, the world of physics really divided into two different camps. Einstein, for all of his revolutionary tendencies, remains kind of classical. He believes there's an independent reality. Bohr doesn't. And I believe in 1962, an Irish physicist named John Wheeler develops the formula to test this debate. It's called Bell's theorem. Bell was feeling that Einstein was correct and his theorem would prove Einstein correct. Another 20 years pass, and a French physicist named Alain Aspect develops the technology to test it. And in the testing, Einstein loses. He's deceased several decades now. But the world of quantum physics discovers that when two particles are entangled as one and then separated, they remain as one. And every test done thereafter proves the same thing. Now, we're now finding that in the macro world, pretty much the same thing exists. Atoms, beryllium atoms, which are not quantum, know when they're being looked at. Take the case of twins, two people, brother and sister. She lives in San Francisco, he lives in Paris. She gets out of the shower and falls and breaks her ankle. She's in pain. At the same instant, he feels a pain in his ankle. They are in an entangled state. Now, some people will say, well, they share the same DNA. But we have countless experiences of these things for people who are not twins. So what I'm getting at here is the first rule of the universe is that the universe is essentially inseparable. Now, if it's inseparable, there's no objectivity. Because to be objective means I stand apart. But nothing stands apart. So the whole notion of diagnosis has no basis. None at all. And that's good news. We all participate in creating and experiencing our realities. And when we can relate to one another subjectively through our perceptions, then this can create a generative dialogue. Instead of the endless argument about, listen to political pundits on TV making objective statements. Nobody ever stops and reconsiders their position. Nothing new is learned. If we learn to language things differently and look at reality differently, the whole thing opens up. By the way,
let me interrupt a minute. This is so interesting that I have neglected to acknowledge the half hour when we're going to go to break.
Okay. Okay.
Before going to break, I want to say first, this is extremely interesting. Any of you listening, I think you should call your friends and tell them to listen to this when it gets up on the archive. I'm going to have fun talking to Ginger about this because we feel like split apart. We feel entangled. And our lives only make sense in that we are, in a sense, one and been entangled before we met.
Yes.
I love this. I love this. Why don't we, if my engineer is with me, let's go to the music and let's go to break. And when we come back, we're just going to continue with Mel Schwartz. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I return to the air with my guest, Mel Schwartz. A couple of things before we continue. When I was probably a freshman or sophomore at Harvard in college, I learned in a course called, the Philosophy of and History of Science, something like that, taught by a gentleman named Cohen, who was an older man, one of those great older men at Harvard at that time, who had been working in the philosophy and history of science his whole life. And one of the things he taught about was the principle of indeterminacy, which Mel has also obviously been influenced by, which says that you can't know the place that an atom is in and its mass at the same time, I think is what it says, because to look at it, you must do something to it. The concept was just looking at it, putting a light source on it, was going to change its mass or its acceleration or some aspect of it, and therefore you never had an exact calculation about all this, and that to a great extent this put a kind of chaotic element or an element of unpredictability into the universe. And I remember also Einstein having a debate, but I think it was with Heisenberg at that point about this, and it sounds like the same debate, and I didn't know this part of it that Mel was talking about. And in that debate, Einstein took the more conservative position scientifically and said, God doesn't play dice with the universe. There isn't a principle of indeterminacy. Now, I actually wrote a paper about this for college in which I said that the principle of indeterminacy gives us reason to believe more in free will. I'm talking about 1956, maybe, 55. And this was not taken well by the TA, the teaching assistant, or whoever it was who read the paper. I don't think that Cohen read it. And since then, I've kind of avoided that kind of thinking, but I've watched it grow around Deepak Chopra and other people, developing this kind of leaping from physics to the spiritual. But Mel is making me a believer. I'm actually having one of those turning point experiences. I think this is really making me more of a believer about the oneness of the whole universe in this regard. So, Mel, thank you, and continue.
My pleasure, Peter. And before I move into indeterminacy and how that can enhance our lives, as an aside, we left off discussing entanglement, and you're speaking of yourself and Ginger.
I actually ran out, Mel, and out of the office, down the hall, and told Ginger, turn the show on, honey. I think you're going to enjoy this.
Well, what is falling in love? Falling in love is about entanglement. It's about letting go of our sense of separateness and creating a sense of oneness. That's what falling in love is. And the experience of falling out of love is a return to separation because of hurts and wounds and grievances and ineffective communication. And it's regrettable. It doesn't need to be that way. Now, coming to indeterminacy, Heisenberg's indeterminacy, also known as the uncertainty principle, which again underscores that objectivity is a myth. Now, let's look at my field, therapy. If the act of looking at an atom meant that you couldn't know everything, could you imagine what happens in a therapy session when a therapist, in their false sense of wisdom, decides that they're going to objectively diagnose how does that impact the person they're working with? Now, I gave a talk a couple of years ago to a room full of very notable Freudian and Jungian analysts. And I was sharing my approach, which is I don't seek objectivity. I don't want it, and it's unattainable. In fact, I seek the opposite. I seek an entanglement whereby I can operate on intuitive levels, which is much faster and much more effective than operating in my rational mind. So one of the gentlemen in the audience asked a question. He said, rather in disbelief, you mean you actually tell your clients what you're thinking? And I said to him, well, tell me, how do you work? He said, well, I wouldn't do that because I would be concerned it would impact them. And I asked him, how do you think your silence impacts them? How do you think the raise of an eyebrow impacts them? Or a sigh? How can they interpret your science? Everything impacts everything. Let's break through this mythology of detached objectivity. And by the way, going back to determinism, now determinism was given to us by Newton. Heisenberg broke that. I believe that the belief in determinism, in predictability, is at the core of a lot of neurosis, particularly anxiety, because people who suffer and struggle with trying to break down and analyze everything so they can safely predict their future event are stuck in this mythology of determinism. When we can learn to embrace uncertainty and benefit from it, life becomes a wondrous experience. So the book I'm writing now, Peter, A Shift of Mind, is suggesting that most of the problems we have, the epidemics of mental and emotional illness, the struggle with happiness and gratification, is due to the fact that we're living from an old worldview, which is tired and out of date, and many people have written about this, which is Newton's worldview speaks of a cold, detached reality made up of objects, in this case we are objects, only connecting to each other through causality, force. There's no meaning, no purpose, not a scintilla of human purpose. Now, that worldview is depressing. So why would it surprise us that we suffer from epidemics of depression? You see, as we see the universe, so we participate in it. Now, compare and contrast that to the new emerging worldview. Right now, we're between worldviews. The old worldview still very much informs our thinking, but there's a shift occurring. Now, the new worldview, which speaks of the inseparability I spoke of before, the uncertainty which you have shared, and on top of that, the potentiality. Everything is a pure state of potential, including us. If we could help people understand and embrace the emerging worldview, then these disorders of anxiety and depression would retreat and they would become what they ought to be, which is the exception. There's a word I came across recently called neurosis, N-O-R-M-O-S-I-S. Neurosis means when something abnormal becomes accepted as normal. That's exactly where we are in Western culture, which is one out of two Americans at some time in their life are going to be diagnosed with a mental illness, and that's neurosis. Nobody's asking why. Why are we experiencing this epidemic, and what do we do to overcome it? That's what my book is focused on. And it's proposing that we can alter the way we think, the way we relate, and the way we communicate when we learn to shift our beliefs and our thinking in alignment with this profound shift that science has opened the door to.
Now, how do folks that you're working with as couples integrate this and respond to this? Because obviously this is very practical for you. You're actually using it in your work. So talk some about that.
Well,
you've
what
done a great
I do
job.
It's
great job philosophically.
I take the theoretical, and again, I'm no scientist, and any scientist would have many objections with what I'm saying, no doubt. But I'm borrowing metaphorically. I take the science and I turn it into a practical application. So, if the science tells us there's no objectivity, well, how will that help a couple? I help their communication. By the way, I'm doing an online workshop currently called the Marriage Mastery Workshop, where I'm teaching these techniques. And the techniques I'm teaching are, well, let's go back to removing the two be verbs. Those are words that exist in Newton's worldview. They have no place in the new participatory worldview. So instead of saying you are, you never, I am, we need to come out of the objective. So if I start my sentence with I feel, I think, we can start to open the dialogue. I learned years ago that if I said it's hot in here, an objective statement, it is, somebody else could say it isn't hot in here. But if I said I feel hot, they can't tell me I don't feel hot. Feelings can't be right or wrong. And in a relationship, I teach people to validate others' feelings. Now, validating doesn't mean I agree. It means I'm in a relationship with you. If you fell down and broke your foot and were in physical pain, I would care. I would assist you. Well, if you're in emotional pain or discomfort, I need to care. So if we learn to language things with I feel, then I can help people try to validate. I'm surprised you feel that way. I didn't know I did that to hurt you or cause that upset. Help me understand how you feel. Now, when you validate someone else, the odds are they're then in the position to validate you. So I develop techniques. There's a technique I develop which I call the 5% rule. When you're in an argument with somebody, your mind is seeking what you can refute and repudiate to prove your point. I'm right and you're wrong. That's ruinous. You can't be right and happy at the same time in a relationship. You have to choose. Do I want to understand or do I want to win? Because winning is losing, ironically. So in the 5% rule, what I propose is if you're in a disagreement or an argument, and arguably you disagree with 95% of what you're hearing, don't latch on to that and use that as a tool to win your point. Find the 5% that you can agree with, and validate it. If you validate the 1% or the 5%, now we have the start of a coherent dialogue. The other person feels heard. If they feel heard, they're in a position now to open up to what you're saying, theoretically. We break the impasse. The belief of right and wrong and the need to be right is an enormous obstacle in relationships, but I find that through introducing new ways of languaging it, we can break through the right or wrong impasse.
I like it. I like it. I don't want to talk. I want to hear you talk some more about aspects of your thinking about this.
Well, take it any way you want, Mel.
Everything that I'm sharing,
Peter, and everything ultimately that I employ as a therapist, it's from my own personal experience. Frankly, when people used to ask me, where was I trained, I would rebel at the word. I'd say, I wasn't trained. I won't be trained. I resist the notion of training. And frankly, there's nothing that I employ in my practice that I was taught in graduate school. My learning doesn't, for the most part, come from the field of psychology. It comes from reading and understanding philosophy, reading and understanding science. I have a very transdisciplinarity approach to life, whereby I embrace complexity. When I buy a book, if I understand everything I've read, it is a waste of my time. I want to buy a book where I'm putting question marks in the column and going back and rethinking it. I wrote an article about that called The Gift of Confusion. See, as a culture, people are reluctant or embarrassed to say they're confused. They don't understand. We have such a need for certitude. It's absolutely horrendous. We need to embrace confusion. When I'm confused, I know that at some future point in time, I'm going to break through. I'm going to have an insight. I'm going to get it. That's exciting. So I want to be confused. That's healthy. It's generative. Frankly, our entire educational system is part of the problem. Can you imagine a classroom in which kids were graded for asking the best questions? Wow. How exciting. And the best question is a question which nobody immediately has an answer for. We're not teaching education. We're teaching kids how to digest and spit back data, pieces of information. That's not education. We're not teaching people how to learn and how to think. We have to value questions and ask them questions we've never asked before. So we've been on a path, I think, toward decline and ruin. And by the way, this isn't just in the field of human wellness or relationships. Ecologically speaking, I'll look at the environment and the ecology. Gregory Bateson did some great work. The great social scientist Gregory Bateson, who was married to Margaret Mead. Bateson wrote a book called Steps to an Ecology of Mind, which speaks to what I'm doing. He spoke of it in a more philosophical way, and I would never compare myself with him. An ecology of mind is a wholeness of thinking, which I aspire to and I teach. I teach people to try to think and see in wholeness. When you see, when you do, when you need to break down and analyze something, you can. But when your mind is oriented toward seeing only parts, analyzing, fragmenting, you miss the big picture. You don't see in wholeness. And when you don't see in wholeness, we have discord and incoherence in our lives. Our environment puts us at peril. We live in a world that's so competitive, insanely competitive, that we're lacking in human compassion, not all of us, of course, but institutionally. It's due to the fact that we're not seeing and appreciating the whole. And I have learned that there is a way to do that. And the way I have done it is by reconsidering how reality is operating and how I'm participating in seeing that. So if I can think and see in wholeness and then reorganize my thoughts, because my thoughts have to be in alignment with this new worldview. Otherwise, I'm tricking myself. My old thinking doesn't make any sense. So all I can say is, for me, this isn't work, as you can probably hear. It's passion. I'm so excited. Every day, I have a new opportunity to look at something differently, to write about it, to work with individuals and couples about it. It's like having the opportunity to create a new life experience for yourself when you go down this path. And
now let me see, we got about 9 minutes left. Let me try to put some of this together in my own way as I'm listening to you.
Yes.
And see where, what kind of question is some sort of a huge question in here. So we're looking at both physical, what we call physical, and maybe eventually that won't work, what we call physical and what we call psychological and spiritual is all interconnected, that you can scientifically show that there are actually things that we consider objects that when separated respond instantaneously to each other, no matter how far apart they are. There's no connection. It's faster than the speed of light, so that somehow these separated beings are actually the same. I got that right?
Well, actually, yes, and I'm going to go even more to the point. I gave a talk called Beyond the Mind-Body Connection, and I, at first, you know, confused people. I said, there is no mind-body connection, and they were surprised to hear me say that. I said, there's no mind-body connection because there's no mind-body separation. They're differing aspects of us. If you take a coin, the head and the tail aren't different. They're part of the same coin. The word connection loses its basis, Peter, because if there's no separation, there's no need for connection. These are all different aspects. What we call objects or material world is simply the temporary condensation, condensing of energy.
Okay, so hang on a minute. So let me go on again. Now we get to energy. And you talked about how love is an aspect, or what, the glue, I would think, of entanglement.
Yes.
That, and then we can take that on a larger level, and most of us who do a lot of reform work, whether it's on my level with Ginger or a level of Gandhi or Martin Luther King, all share that view that there is a quality of love that we have which makes us all one in some way, makes us all interconnected in some way. Now, so we're developing an idea that there's this enormous interconnection that is occurs whether Ginger and I are sleeping in separate beds, or whether particles are separated. Now, where do you go with the next step of that? Is this a concept of some kind of overarching spirituality? Makes me think of the Force concept in that series of movies, when a planet explodes, sensitive people around the world feel the pain of all these people being destroyed.
You know, arguably, Peter, we're all made from the same stardust. Actually, we're all comprised of the material of the universe prior to the Big Bang. So there is no separation. I have found that the science, the new science, is profoundly spiritual.
I'm laughing. We're all made of the same stardust. All right, so do you think the stardust is it? Do you think there's a God? Do you think there's some other force? What are your biggest questions?
Speaking of entanglement, I was anticipating that question. I believe in creative intelligence. I don't believe in a patriarchal God. What I believe in is that there is no chance, in my understanding, of the universe having developed by accident. But I believe that the creative force of the universe is also inseparable. That creative intelligence, Peter, is you. The tree outside your office, the planet, the galaxy, all of us are that creative intelligence, because it could not have evolved by accident. A physicist described this once perfectly for me. He said, the chance of life having happened by accident is the equivalent of a tornado blowing through a junkyard and accidentally assembling a 747 aircraft. Couldn't happen. Yet, I believe in evolution. But I don't believe in evolution at the exclusion of creative intelligence. One truth doesn't preclude another truth, and that's the problem with how we were trained to think. We don't engage complexity. We seek quick answers where one thing is and another thing isn't. But I believe that all of the universe, which includes us, is profoundly as one. Carl Jung called it unus mundus, one reality, one world. The teachings of Eastern religions have always suggested that, and science is confirming it. So I don't come at it from the New Age spiritual place. I come at it from a practical utilitarian place. As science teaches us this, let's develop approaches to enhance our lives and unfetter ourselves, and let's all benefit from it.
I'm thinking about how you could title your book, Created from the Same Stardust.
Well, maybe that'll be the next one. By the way, with these applications, there'd be no more need for a hatred or warfare because we are all as one. It would be like my left hand attacking my right hand because it sees its opposition, not knowing it's part of the same body.
Well, that is certainly the spiritual ideal of probably all the great leaders that I admire. That in fact we are all made of the same stuff. Now I can call it stardust.
Right.
That we are all in this together, that we all are affecting each other one way or another, for better and worse, and that the ultimate solution is that, as Jesus said, I say that as a Jew by birth, as Jesus said, you know, we have to love one another, that's the essence. And you're just making lovely connections all around that I think are quite inspiring.
And as you referenced before, I almost read in the reference you made about you and Ginger having known each other before, you know, nearly half the population of the world believes in reincarnation.
Well actually, I wasn't suggesting that, although maybe that's so. I was suggesting that that like split aparts, we were looking for each other.
Yes.
I wasn't saying we'd known each other before, but our lives seemed to confirm that we were growing together toward the same purpose, including being together.
Yes.
And the work we do and the way we affect the world and each other and so on.
Yeah, so it's a convergence.
But I'm open to it all.
That's excellent. I believe in the possibility of everything.
everything good, hopefully.
Yeah, by all means.
Mel, we're going to be finished in a very short time. I usually get a two-minute warning. Tell me a couple of parting thoughts for folks.
Well, maybe where I just left off, all things are possible. I have found it in my professional work with people. Amazing things happen. Just when hope is lost, there's an epiphany. A marriage which was about to go off to the matrimonial attorneys shifted in an instant. I think that an insight is the most powerful thing in the universe, a new way of seeing. But we all have insights. But the problem is that they pass, they fade. When I have an insight, I make a commitment to that insight, Peter. I say to myself, this could be a defining moment in my life. Committing to the insight and making it a defining moment where you say to yourself, I am changed because of this insight. I commit
Thank
to this
you.
Insight. That's investing in yourself.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Mel Schwartz. Thank you for a lovely hour.
My pleasure, Peter. Nice meeting you.